So I'm here in the South Bank in the exhibition Force Fields with its curator Guy Brett, and we're going to walk around the exhibition, and we're starting with
Calder and Van Tongeloo. I took Van Tongeloo and Calder as kind of two key artists for the entire exhibition, really. I mean, not that everybody in the exhibition was influenced by them or even aware of their work necessarily, but I think that they made some discoveries which are kind of echoed by really most of the work in the show in one form or another. They were both at different moments very inspired by the cosmos, I suppose, by astronomy. Van Tongeloo, as you probably know, I mean, he started off as a de Stijl, a geometric painter after the war, and the fashions had changed, and he'd been forgotten. And embarked on this extraordinary work in which he tried to find a way of suggesting, I suppose, the measureless, you know, the infinity of space, the energies of the cosmos. I mean, all these words sound very generalized and vague, but of course, I had the feeling that he made these what were sort of models, but they were aesthetic models, not scientific models. They were intuitive, poetic models that could stand for the awareness we've come to have of, you know, the immensity of space and time, and on the other hand, the minutiae, you know, of space and time at the same time.
So, you use the word model, which is a word that you use in the essay in various different moments. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yes, I mean, the word model is useful because it suggests that the object is a kind of distillation or approximation to something that's too great to grasp, or at least it makes graspable, even sometimes you mean, you know, actually physically, manually graspable, something whose dimensions are just more than we can understand. But it also relates to me to the whole question of abstraction, you see. I feel that this discovery of abstraction in the 20th century is a phenomenon that's capable of many different kinds of interpretation, and it goes beyond a question of style, I think, which is the normal way in which, you know, art historical changes are described. I think that abstraction has been a way in which artists have tried to produce models of reality when the old means of representation have, you know, proved to be too limited. And so as we got an enormously expanded sense of what reality is, we needed visual models. Of course, they're not scientific models, because art is not the same thing as science, even though it's very can be very closely interconnected, because it's a poetic model. Therefore, you know, it touches on many matters that don't have necessarily to do with just the physical aspects of reality. Touches on the sense of wonder, the sense of awe, or the sense of terror, or the sense of beauty, perfection. And I think that, you know, Van Tongeloo vision really was one of the perfect side, the light side of the universe, if you like. Whereas other artists have actually been more concerned with the dark side, on the obscure side of it. So we have both things. I think we have both things in this show.
And Van Tongeloo's paintings here also.
Again, these always seem fascinating to me when I remember that the person who painted them was somebody who for years painted geometric abstraction. He obviously came to feel that the geometric and the organic were not mutually exclusive. I suppose he came to see that there was some principle like running through both these constructs. He tried to arrive at a visualization of that sort of energy, which was neither just physical and neither just biological. They also evoke, you know, those kind of spiritualist paintings that got associated with theosophy and Rudolf Steiner and so on, which tend to be a bit, actually, in a sense, lacking in energy, because I think you have to have a concept. It has to communicate thinking and thought. It can't be just some vague, undefined, sort of diffuse nothing, you know.
the paintings themselves and the forms within them all feel like containers in some way, I think. Mm-hmm. It was reminding me of Helio Ortizica.
Oh, yeah, with
his...
containers.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's true. Mm, there actually should have been those containers in this show, Ortizica's, but unfortunately they didn't arrive from Brazil. To have a Ortizica just down there, just next to this painting, would actually be really rather amazing. I hadn't thought of that.
So right next to Van Tongelu are two very beautiful early Calder pieces.
Yes, these are very early mobiles. They were just after the time when Calder had been doing his wire circus. In one sense, they do carry on from the ideas of his circus. They have forms in equilibrium and balance, you know, geometric forms floating in space. At the same time, Calder was very inspired by astronomy. But the interesting thing about Calder, I think, is that everyone has in their mind, you know, the typical Calder mobile, because he did produce so many mobiles. And as time went on, in a curious way, I think he became more and more terrestrial in his references. They look more like leaves or branches of trees or things that we associate with the Earth. But these early ones, I think, are far more cosmic, I call it. The ease with which he handles space with wire lines and outlines it just hasn't lost any of its wit and its economy, its effortlessness. There's nothing ever anything labored about any work of Calder's.
So what is it about the early period of Calder and the late period of Van Tongelu that led you to use them as leitmotifs through the show? Which aspects of them and in what way?
It's encapsulated in the title, I suppose, Force Fields. I wanted to have this theme of energy, space and time running through everything, because I thought it was a thread, really, that you could trace through the 20th century. Of course, a lot of people are calling this the kinetics exhibition, and I know the word kinetic occurs in the subtitle, but it's not an exhibition of kinetic art as a historical movement, and nor, of course, do all the works in the exhibition physically move. There's a lot of work which is static, and there's a lot of work which is actually done in the most ancient technique of art there is, which is drawing. So it's paradoxical in that sense. In a way, it poses the question as to what actually movement is, because, of course, everything in the universe is in movement, but we can only perceive movement and stasis in relation to one another. There's nothing absolutely static, and there's nothing absolutely in motion. It's all a question of relative relationship. After Van Tongelu, you come to these little drawings by Vols. Mm. I mean, this is something I very, very much wanted to do, was to put together bodies of work which historically have always been considered at opposite poles. So I thought, you know, that those kind of hostilities and disagreements are a vital part of, you know, establishing your identity and your vision. But when, with the passage of time, I have the feeling that, you know, you can find connections which arise from a particular historical, social and cultural moment, which are there, which may not have been consciously put there. So I always think that, like, Van Tongelu may be looking at the heavens, and Vols might be looking at, you know, the microscopic and the microbiological.
I was particularly surprised by the scale, having only seen them in reproduction. Mm-hmm. Had this idea of it as quite, you know, a large thing, and it's absolutely jewel-like there. Exactly, it's amazing.
It's true, and it's a fascinating thing, because in fact you have to preserve the scale. If you enlarge a Vols, you don't gain anything from enlarging it. In fact, you lose something. I was so intrigued by the structures that he was, you know, improvising, that I thought, how would it be to enlarge a detail of these structures? And I tried doing it, but curiously enough, it didn't work at all, because it just looked like, you know, a larger scale abstract painting.
Mm-hmm. Phenomenally detailed.
This room really is a room of turbulences. You've got the vault here, then you've got some Fontana drawings on the other wall. They're abstract force fields in a way, turbulences in the clouds or something like that. And then on the other wall you have Henri Michaux's mescaline drawings. And of course they're unbelievably turbulent. Incidentally, that sound you can hear now is Len Lai's blade.
Shall we go and have a look?
We can have a look at it, yeah. Len Lai was born in New Zealand, you know, and he's well known as an avant-garde filmmaker and a pioneer of animated abstract film. It's a vertical shaft of steel plate. With a ball which doesn't itself move. The ball is just struck by the plate at certain moments which are impossible to predict. I think that Len Lai must have been inspired by these immense storms you get in the South Pacific. From childhood, I mean, because, you know, he left New Zealand when he was a young artist. I think these memories were always in his mind.
We're just walking up the ramp past this fantastic Hans Hacker piece. It's a long... Is it white satin or silk?
Something like satiny material. It can be of different lengths, but it's incredibly simple. It's a fan which is ruffling along a sheet of satiny material, producing a kind of current which runs all the way along it, like a wave. And just beyond it is Hacker's sphere in air jet, in which a balloon is floating in space in the air from a fan on the ground. I think a lot of people probably don't realise that Hans Hacker made this kind of work before he started on the political and social installations that he's best known for. But of course he himself would say that there was a sort of a very clear transition between this early work and his later work, in the sense that they both had to do with interactive systems. But in these early works, it's interpreted in terms of natural forces. There's another one upstairs, the condensation cube, yeah.
So what is the piece of work we're hearing right now?
That is a work of Tanguy, Jean Tanguy. I think Tanguy's humour is something that is very, very precious in 20th century art. It's not a reason not to take him seriously, because he has that kind of Chaplin humour which actually has sort of very deep humanistic roots, which is one of the series he called Baluba. This should be moving faster than it is at the moment, I think.
I had a sense it would be slightly wilder.
It should be really wild, because the movement of the motor, the vibration set up by the motor, just get everything going. And these balubas were probably the most anarchic and freest machines that Tanguy made. And curiously enough, the reason they're called baluba is because at that time Tanguy was very interested in Patrice Lumumba, who was the man who led the independence movement in Zaire, you know, what was the Belgian Congo, and he was a member of the Baluba tribe. Tanguy admired him very much. He admired his political vision, and so these sculptures, which are some way inspired by African dance as well, and also actually by Brazilian dance, because Tanguy had visited Brazil and Africa at the time he made these works. We also have two works of Yves Klein's in here, two of his fire paintings. Tanguy and Yves Klein had this amazing collaborative show that they did at Iris Clare Gallery in 1957, I think it was. And I think it was a very, very significant collaboration, which isn't perhaps known in art history as well as it should be. It was called Vitesse Pure, a Stabilité Monochrome. Yves Klein made these monochromatic discs, and Tanguy made the machines on which these discs were spinning, and they span at different speeds, and some span very, very fast, and others span more slowly. And Tanguy made these kind of structures that supported the discs which were spinning. And Yves Klein felt that, you know, his painting element represented the sort of ethereal and spiritual, if you like, and that Tanguy's machine, which was made of junk, represented the sort of earthly, and it was the combination of these two things that excited both of them so much.
Ah, now, this is an absolutely fantastic room to see.
You like this room? Yes, Gego, I mean, until very recently, I think, was completely unknown outside Venezuela, where she lived. She went to Venezuela when she was already grown up. She was a refugee from Germany before the war. And she worked away quietly there, and I think only a small circle of people were aware of these works until very recently, and so they've never been shown on this scale in Britain before. Again, Geiger was an artist who began in a much more rigid, geometric style and gradually loosened her work until her old age, and interestingly, in her old age, produced her most free and fragmentary, I suppose, structures. That you can see, like the two hanging against the wall there, that she called dibujos sin papel, or drawings without paper.
What we're looking at are hanging wire constructions made by looping or articulating wire into geometric shapes in some cases, and more free hanging shapes in others. And occasionally, some of the wire is coloured. They're like webs. And networks.
They are very much like lines in space. They do have a very strong graphic quality, although they occupy three-dimensional space. And I think that one very special aspect of Gego's work is her system of joining the elements. It's very simple, it's very economical, but it becomes a visual element in itself, again, like a kind of node. And there's the sense of flow that is produced out of what are actually rigid pieces of metal. It's quite clear when you look at these things that they could refer to, you know, jungle vegetation. But it's nothing so literal as that. It's just that you can undoubtedly feel it.
So we've come outside on the roof of the Hayward Gallery to see David Medalla's Cloud Gates.
Yes, this is David Medalla's bubble machines called Cloud Gates, which consists of four tall perspex hollow rectangular structures arranged in a square formation so that you can actually see right through them. In the base of each one is a tank of water mixed with detergent and air pumps, which create bubbles, foam, which is climbing up the towers and emerging from the top. When the wind's blowing, because we're right outside in the balcony here, pieces of foam detach themselves and float away and blow away. Depending on the wind, the currents, how strong the wind is, you get all sorts of different shapes that float away and travel quite far over the surrounding streets.
As a complete form, yeah.
Yeah, as a complete form, unpredictable in its shape. I have been walking around the Hayward Gallery and down the road over there, and seeing these pieces of foam float by and sometimes attach themselves to walls and fences. And then I've gone up and studied it and closely and see that although it's resting there, it's only going to stay there for a few seconds because it's all the time gradually disintegrating.
I suppose this is a very literal reading of this work, but it's mixture of this very solid form and this amorphous production.
No, I mean, I think that was very deliberate. This particular work, which is a sort of recent version of David's bubble machines, is a kind of homage to Mondrian, because it was originally part of an exhibition he made called The Secret History of the Mondrian Fan Club. At the base of each one is a different primary colour. So So yes, it does refer to Mondrian. And when David first made these bubble machines in the 60s, you could also say that they somehow referred to minimalism, because they had, you know, regular geometric shapes. But of course that was played with and contradicted by this amorphousness, which always played around the geometry and disturbed it and played around it and exceeded it, really, I suppose, because there was sort of somehow no limit to this creation of forms that were all the time appearing and disappearing. And I think it was also a kind of way of playing with the idea of monumentality as well, because they have a sort of monumental...
They certainly do, yeah.
...kind of a massiveness, but that's again contradicted by the fact that everything evaporates.
So moving from David Medalla's piece, we're walking into a space filled with Takis's electromagnetic sculptures, which are quite extraordinary. Objects held or moved in space by electromagnets.
Yes, Takis's field has sort of invented a kind of set of forms and energies that are very particular sculptural creation and have to do with making the centre of his work an immaterial force, which is the force of magnetism. In this room, there is the first magnetic sculpture he ever made, which was in 1959. A piece here, which basically consists of a flat platform standing on little legs with three masts at one end. And at the other end, a magnet is mounted. And there are two nails and one cone, which are floating in space, because they're tethered to the at one end to the three masts. And in a sense, that little gap of empty space is the real heart of the work. You can't see anything, but that's where all the energy is concentrated.
He's created this visually powerful void.
Exactly, and incorporated a source of actual energy within the sculpture itself. It's not a representation of something, it actually contains it.
Takis also floated a human being, didn't he?
Yes, he did. A friend of his, a poet, whose name was Sinclair Beiles. That was another of these marvellously crazy events that Iris Clare staged in her gallery. This was actually 1960, and it was the same year that, Gagarin made his first trip into space. But Takis always claims that he had sent someone into space before Gagarin, who was Sinclair Beiles, who was sitting in a kind of chair construction that was floating in space because of the action of some very, very large magnets that Takis had installed. And Sinclair had a crash helmet on in case he tumbled out of the chair and recited a poem called I Am a Sculpture, in which he suggested that all hydrogen bombs should be turned into sculptures.
And the piece that we're hearing, there are three wires of different thickness held taut with large, like needles, they look like.
Yeah, probably needles for making sails or something, very large needles. There's this electromagnet behind, and when the electromagnet comes on, the needle's drawn over the wire, and the sound is amplified by an amplifier. Takis always likes to include a sound element in his exhibitions.
So we've arrived at the table of Lydia Clark's work. They are all interactive pieces in which you make or do something. And right now Guy is sticking together his Meba strip for the piece Caminando.
Caminando, yes. It means walking. Well, Lydia Clark was an artist who was very much concerned with the body, also with the participation of the spectator, the person actually physically using their body to interact with the work. That's something that she developed throughout her life in many different ways. Here we have three, what she would call propositions, things that anybody can pick up and do or make out of ordinary materials, which nevertheless relate to the body in some very intimate way. The one I'm doing is Caminando. It involves taking a strip of paper, twisting it to form a Möbius band, and then inserting a pair of scissors, which I'm doing now, into this band of paper and starting to cut along the band. This is the walking, or walking can mean also just going. She says that this work consists in the act as it's taking place. Nothing exists before, nothing exists afterwards, so that you would simply become conscious of the act as you do it. When you've gone once round the Möbius loop, you arrive back at the point where you started. Then you have to decide if you're going to go to the left or the right of the original cut. And once you've decided that, you keep going. Basically, you go on until you can't cross any longer.
All of the pieces here and Lydia Clark's other work have this therapeutic side to them, in a sense of bodily exploration.
Certainly, and in fact, Lydia herself felt that these kind of discoveries she'd made about the body, the act, this sensory experience that she had kind of focused by this series of participatory objects that she made, could have the effect of reawakening memories which she felt were located in the body itself, below the level of consciousness, below the level of language, and that in some way that she could reconnect with these memories in a specific individual and in fact use that process in a therapeutic sense. So she did, towards the end of her life, practice a form of therapy with people using her objects, which of course she communicated to the psychiatric profession in Brazil. Naturally enough, it produced very mixed reactions. Some people were really extremely impressed and very fascinated by what she was doing. Others dismissed it contemptuously. But the whole story is difficult to sum up in a few words. Mm. I mean, it really is, when you come to think that this was an artist who started off again in the geometric tradition, she was influenced by Mondrian, Albers at the beginning, and Max Bill, and those people who had an influence in Brazil, that if you look at the whole course of her life, that she began like that and ended with this form of, this kind of form of healing or medicine, which was not just changing one's métier. It was something that really came out of her artistic discoveries.
Also in this space, we have this remarkable piece over here.
Yes, this is the other large machine of Len Lai's in the exhibition, and it's called Universe. It is a large, I should say about 6 foot diameter steel band in a loop, which is standing on its edge on a very solid base, and above it there is suspended from the ceiling a ball, sort of size that could fit into your hand, made of a very hard New Zealand wood. He called it loop originally, and then when he turned it on there was a small boy who said, "Oh, that noise reminds me of the universe." So he changed the title to Universe. It makes a large, very tough piece of steel move with an extraordinary fluidity. It isn't moving at the moment. It rolls, and it appears as if it's going to roll off the base altogether. It springs up and down, but with a very beautiful movement because of the size of the loop. And the sound it makes has got a kind of haunting quality that echoes through the whole building.
Mm. Mm. So I'd like to ask as well, this subject area of movement and energy is obviously one that you've spent many years being interested in. And I know that some 30 years ago, the Hayward made a show of kinetic sculpture specifically, and that you reviewed that, calling for a kind of a wider view of that period and a wider structure within which that work could be seen. So can you tell me about your interest specifically and why you made this exhibition?
You know, when I was starting to write about art and starting to get really interested in art, it's true that that moment was the moment of this sort of first appearance of kinetic work, let's call it that for the sake of convenience. At that time, it seemed to me that this was the most exciting direction, really, in contemporary art. It was extending the boundaries of what a work of art was. It was using new materials, new forces, bringing all of those things into the sphere of art. There was a group of us who had this very strong interest, and in fact in the 60s, David Medalla and Paul Keeler and a number of other people started a gallery called Signals. More than a gallery, it was more of a sort of experimental art centre, I suppose, in London. And we were all particularly interested in kinetic work, and we got to meet most of the artists, Dangeli, Taki, Soto, Ligia Clark, and others who were doing that kind of work, meet them and become friends with them. And it also interested me a lot that that people who were the developers of this movement, the pioneers of it, came from many different countries of the world. I was very aware that there was a New York school of abstract expressionism and there was the whole European history of modernism. But it seemed that this tendency really embraced people from all over the world. I mean, there were Latin Americans, there were Chinese. So I did write a little book about kinetic art in 1968. And then times changed, I got interested in different things, became quite politicized and got very interested in the relationship of art and politics and society. But in, I don't know, the last 5 or 6 years, I began to, you know, think again about that movement, that moment. I began to think that actually this had not really remained very visible, perhaps because this kind of work didn't have a very close relationship with the art market, whereas pop art, conceptual art, minimal art, and so on were very well-known phenomena and were well represented in museums. It seemed that a lot of this kinetic work was invisible. And at a certain point, Manuel Boja Viel, who is the director of the MACBA in Barcelona, who I had already knew and had already worked with him on an exhibition of Oiticica and an exhibition of Ligia Clark, said to me one day, have you ever thought of doing a reappraisal of kinetic art? I didn't want to just recapitulate on the history of kinetic art because there was a lot of work which was not very interesting, as there is in all movements. So I said, more interesting could be to do something which actually tries to link these movements of which have got frozen into these categories with a much more fluid sense of experimentation. Because I did feel very strongly that actually the kinds of experimentation that artists were doing at that period was very fluid, in fact. You see, maybe you have someone like Jean Tinguely, but he was very closely related to Yves Klein, to the New Realists, to people like Daniel Spori, people who were working with everyday materials. And then another connection would have been the concrete poetry movement, where people experimenting with their kinetic poetry. There was a fluidity in all of these experimental movements, which had got, for the convenience of the market or for the academic ways of treating art history, had all got separated. So I thought, well, we'll give an indication of how these things were connected. And also we would try to suggest that these artists were actually trying to deal with like the biggest subjects there are, you know, which always come down, in fact, to the individual. And like Ligia Clark, I think, is a good example of somebody who would actually work with the individual person in all their specificity, their individual history and their mind and everything. But there would always be the purpose, there would always be the desire to link, you know, that individual with the cosmos. I mean, she in fact said, I'm trying to indicate the interior cosmos. Those metaphors to me are very significant.
So it seems a very relevant show for right now, but I was wondering if you made any relationships with other works, more contemporary works coming out of this
show. Well, I could give you an example of that, because at one point I seriously considered extending the exhibition up to contemporary period. But I thought that that was conceptually very difficult to manage, because the more historical distance you have on a phenomena, the more you're able to encapsulate it in certain ways. And also you tend to suggest that there are sort of linear developments of things through time, because I've seen so many exhibitions that attempt to do that. And I always feel that the contemporary section's a disappointment, because either the selection is not rigorous enough, or the connections are so forced that it's not illuminating, really. But I would have liked to have had a sort of parallel show of some contemporary work which could have been related by people without forcing the issue. And one of the works that I would have included in that, if I'd done it, was Susan Hiller's Witness, the piece that now is actually in the Tate, intelligence show. Although maybe a lot of this work has a kind of optimism that is difficult to find today, and today we have made far more use of irony in dealing with reality, I suppose because we realize that the element of subjectivity in any description of anything is so powerful that it's hard to know what really reality is or where truth lies, you see. And perhaps truth lies in actually being honest about the fact that there are these multitudes of subjectivities, whereas so much of this work attempts a sort of objectivity. The fascinating thing about Susan Hiller's work is that it tries to deal with the question of the universe, but it does it through collecting together a huge collection of subjective accounts of precisely that feeling of the fact that there is some vast thing out there, you know, that is part of us, but we don't know what it is. She did it by collecting together all these accounts of people who had sighted UFOs and other celestial phenomena and so on. So I thought that would be fine, because that would introduce a certain sense of irony and relativity into the issue, but would also be capable of exciting exactly that same feeling of awe and wonder, you know, that you get from so much of this work. People are enjoying this exhibition so much and don't feel that it's, you know, a sort of exhuming something dead from the past. I mean, I'm in a way quite, not surprised, but delighted, you know, that actually it has had such a reaction.